My name is Jeff Harbach. I'm the CEO of Coffin Fellows and the host of the Coffin Fellows podcast. This season, our podcast is produced in partnership with Mighty Capital and features different Coffin Fellows as co-hosts. In this podcast, we dive deep into the personal narratives of some of the most successful names in the venture capital industry. But we're not here just to explore their highlight reels, however impressive they are. From failures and formative learning experiences to inflection points and aha moments, we discuss the real, authentic journeys that each individual goes through to become the best version of themselves in order to best serve the entrepreneurs they invest in. Covering various themes in venture capital investing, we speak with the world's top leaders in capital formation, all from a place of authenticity and vulnerability. Together, we'll unravel what truly makes a great venture capital investor. Now let's meet today's host and their guest.
Hi, I'm Ronka Stichelaitis, founder of Contrarian Ventures, and I'm excited to host this series on the journey to net zero. Let's hear from my guest today.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be here with Carmichael Roberts. Thanks a lot for joining us at Kaufman Fellows. It's really, really great to have you today with us.
Great to be here, Rokas. It's great to be here.
So let's get on to it. Let's start with a short introduction. I don't know, I've looked for your resume and you know, you've done so many things and it's really, really impressive. I wanted just to start to walk through your background and, you know, how do you got to where you are now?
Yeah. So first, you know, the group probably knows, where am I? Maybe let's start with that. Yeah. You know, right now I've got my founded my own fund, Material Impact Fund, which manages hundreds of millions of dollars. And then I'm one of two of the principal decision makers for Breakthrough Energy Ventures. Bill Gates started that fund, as we know, with close to 30 billionaires investing in it. And that's over $2 billion under management, all focused on climate. And I'm one of the two principal decision makers. So that's where I'm at right now. Now, I can tell you all about my time at Harvard, my time at Duke, my time at MIT. But you know what's really cool? A lot of people don't really talk about their personal journey in addition to their professional journey because it's so private. But for me, it's not really. I think it's important to get it out there. So how I really got to where I'm at, let me go backwards a little bit, I'd say. So when I was really young, around 2 or 3 years old, my parents got divorced. And actually, I never lived with my mother or my father until later in life when I was starting to get closer to be a teenager. And I bounced around a lot, living with different people in my family in rough neighborhoods in New York. So I was born in Queens, but I lived in parts of Brooklyn. In fact, a part of Brooklyn called East New York. And I lived in the projects. You know, I was supported with by the government on food stamps, free lunches at the park, you know, cheese, government cheese, you know, things like that. I have to say, I loved my childhood, but I really like to try to own that and describe that because it actually makes the basis of who I am, because I learned how to take care of myself at a really young age. Yep. And I just learned how to really understand people. I had to, because, you know, I was kind of thrust. I had no brothers and sisters either. I should add that. I was an only child in the midst of that. And I think all my sensory and my EQ just was elevated at a young age because it had to be. And then fortunately, later on, I picked up a lot of the academics over a period of time. So one thing I always like to say is pretty obvious, especially being the fact that I'm an African-American male, in regards to whether you were black or white, in that background, I'm a statistical anomaly for what I'm doing right now. And I think that combination is what got me to where I'm at. That combination of the Harvard, Duke, MIT, technically trained, combined with like the people skills that allowed me to go into rural environments, urban environments, cross over all sorts of economic boundaries in any direction, and really just understand people.
So people are at the core, I think. When one looks at your journey to what you just described in the early days, you've been persevered to the minimum to describe that journey, right? You've founded so many companies. You've been investing for over two decades. How does one, you know, go and jump this and achieve so much in a short period of time? What was sort of the motivation for the whole time as you approached another journey?
Yeah, so that gets into the guts of the part that I didn't tell you about. I sort of told you just now about how I started and where I'm at, but what's in between? Like what really got me going, like you said? So there's a couple of common threads. The first thing is, and I couldn't articulate this really clearly when I was in my late teens and early 20s, but eventually I got this, and that is, I am singularly focused on solving some of the world's most important problems and true needs. I'm talking like keeping the world healthy, fed, safe, warm, secure, empowered. That's what drove me in academia. I was on track to be a professor when I was an NSF fellow at Harvard in the chemistry department. And I would have done that, except I realized there's so many brilliant professors out there in hard science who have great potential solutions, but can't, they really don't have anyone to translate those solutions into products that make a difference in those topics that I just made. And that started my entrepreneurial journey, right? My entrepreneurial journey was, how do I flip it a bit? The academic community, that's my crew. I mean, that's my group. I'm so close to academia. I think they see me as part of them, except I play a different role. I partner with a bunch of major universities from all around the world and help try to help translate the work, great work that they're doing and the great people there into businesses and companies. And I did the first half of my career doing that as an entrepreneur. I learned how to be a founder of things. I learned how to be CEO of things, raise money, do deals with large companies, work closely with the government, which I think is very important.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I met a lot of venture capitalists. You know, this is a Kauffman, you know, program. I should say, you know, this is important to for venture capitalists to work with people like I was at that point in time. And then I became almost, you know, they became my partners as well in venture. And that's how I ended up sort of transitioning over, was like a gray into venture, where the main motivation there was I got to a point in my career, Rokas, that I realized to scale what I was doing, I need to learn how to teach people how to do what I do on some of the problems in the business model and the approach.
Yeah.
So that's what I do now, right? So the second half of my career, where I sit now, is really on the venture platform, but really helping phenomenal entrepreneurs, operators, inventors do what I've been doing my whole life, like go after solving those problems that, you know, culminate with things like healthcare and climate.
It's fascinating. I think you've founded quite a few companies in the healthcare space. And as you said, you're targeting really, you know, one of the most complex problems in the world. And that leads on to, you know, Material Impact Fund and BEV eventually. I think frequently it comes across that you mentioned this term called resilient technology. Can you expand on that? Because that seems like a big, big, important part in your sort of thesis and thinking.
You know, this has been something I've been talking about for over 10 years. I think today everybody will get this, right? Imagine if you're really working on the world's most important problems out there, here's what cannot happen. Whether it's Mother Nature who comes along with something completely disruptive like a storm or you know, something that one can't predict when it hits, huge change in temperature, or whether it's man-made, like someone comes in and does something that they shouldn't, either by accident or deliberately. You can't have the most important products addressing the most important problems go down. When you're talking about things like, you know, providing heat and warmth and food and water and security, you do not want those things to go down. So think about this. When you're developing a product or a business around that, it's not only important to make sure the cost and the performance of those things work and reach the masses, but it's important that those products and services themselves are well protected and otherwise resilient. So let's just think about the last couple of years.
Yeah.
What the heck? Let's just think about the last 18 months, focus. I mean, we could look at the pandemic and we could see something that was clearly not predicted precisely as to when. I know Bill Gates certainly foreshadowed some of it.
Yeah.
But when it hit and the way it hit and the global impact, whoa. And think about how certain businesses and products just completely disappeared because of it.
Yeah.
It's okay if, you know, I'll just speak.
And it happened over literally, a few days, I think.
Exactly.
When it hit it, really everyone.
Yeah. And so we were starting to worry about food supply and chain and, you know, how we get medicines to places and can we go into hospitals? I mean, you begin to think, that's not resilient. And even if, let's take something more recent. Let's look in the last 3 or 4 or 5 months, right? What have we seen? We've seen, let me pick one. We've seen like an amazing state like Texas, who is incredibly independent in the U.S., you know, one of our most independent and proud states, who I think does a lot of stuff great. But even Texas all of a sudden got a quick change in temperature. And what happens?
Yeah.
Electricity gets challenged. Like the power gets challenged. The water supply gets challenged. The health gets challenged. That's, you know, that's scary. That's not resilient. Or even think about, I talk about man-made stuff, the cyber attacks. And, you know, that can, you know, shut down your ability to get gas or exchange information or, you know, even worse on the healthcare side of stuff, right? The products that get made need to withstand anything that comes at them. So I think it's more than just addressing the most important problems in the world. I think in addition to that, one must also look at designing those things in a way that they're resilient, virtually almost impervious to things that can completely knock them out.
No, this is really important in the context of where we are, especially, you know, you having had so much experience founding companies in the healthcare space, right? Funneling to a topic of climate, right? Frequently people refer that, you know, while, you know, COVID might have been a wave, we're going to be hit by a tsunami. So coming back to BEV, you know, Breakthrough Energy Ventures, you know, you got to the point where you're joining this great consortium of, you know, backers and really most influential people led by Bill Gates. What were the primary reasons that led you to join BEV and launch it eventually?
Yeah, so let's take the two things that you just said, joining BEV and the launching of BEV. Let me, for accuracy's sake, let me give credit where credit is due. Bill Gates launched BEV. He's the founder of it. And thank goodness he did. I think if I go back to that, and maybe if I will, I was on the outside as an observer watching this before I got, I'm deep in the inside, as I mentioned. So I can tell you from the outside on what I saw and from the inside, which got validated. If you look at the first wave of effort around climate, in fact, most people didn't call it climate. Most folks said renewable energy or clean tech at that time. Yeah. In fact, we often say clean tech, one died all, right? So if you look at that at that point in time, there were lots of firms and individuals and institutions who were participating. And then, you know, it didn't turn out quite the way anybody wanted. But at the same time, we can also notice that the problems only got worse. But we also learned a tremendous amount. And there were people in there, people like Bill Gates, who were doing a lot of great work in there and learning a lot. And he's a voracious learner, by the way. I mean, that's one thing I share with, I think everybody knows that. And he translates that into trying to solve some of the world's most important problems, whether it's education or health or, and, you know, in the case, I have the pleasure to work with BEV and climate. And so what do you do next? Nothing changes unless you change something. And so one of the things that was pretty clever, and I'll use one word that he really leaned into, and that's collaborate. So he went and got 30 or so extremely high net worth, well-connected people from all around the world to join him in the first step towards educating the world, educating themselves, learning more and working together and across their geographies around climate. And that was a coalition that he built. There was no venture fund at that point in time.
Yeah.
And we saw things like the group, a subset of them standing on the stage in Paris, at the Paris Accords, for example. Then the next thing was, all right, where did some of the solutions come from? And this is where I began to enter. And that 2.0 move, the other part is the venture group. They raised a little over $1 billion where a subset of them put the money in around this very specific concept. Part of the solution, perhaps a major piece of the solution, will be innovation addressing some of these problems. And that gets done best by phenomenal entrepreneurs, great companies, and hopefully the venture community getting behind it. And BEV was created around that. And so I had just with one of my close friends, Adam Sharkawi, he and I had just started and launched Material Impact, which, as you correctly stated, cuts across all sorts of topics. It certainly will hit climate as well, but it hits a bunch of other really important topics that aren't necessarily climate. It's like stuff in healthcare, for example.
Yeah.
And then comes along the BEV, who has an opportunity for me to join an investment committee of a fund that had very few people. So, in fact, it had almost no people. So there were about four or five of us who got together underneath that board that was chaired by Bill Gates. And the group of us had the opportunity to not only figure out who we hire, but to really create the strategy around the mission and the vision that was instigated and crafted around Bill Gates. The mission was really clear, you know, use innovation to try and thwart and stave off what could be a complete catastrophe if we don't stop what's going on in climate. Is certainly the mission. And the vision is use this collaboration with venture being the centerpiece. And here we sat, and I got a chance to be one of the two investment committee members, while I also had my own fund. And that was, roughly about 5 years ago, which was a fantastic moment for me in time in my career.
It's an amazing timing as well of it, where we are now, I think, reflecting back on the last 5 years. So you mentioned two words that I really picked up, which is collaboration and coalition. So I think you just recently announced that, you're partnering with the European Commission beyond your 100 million fund now to Breakthrough Energy Coalition, which you're going to deploy over $1 billion in technologies across hydrogen, long-term battery storage, and alternative fuels. This is great. So I think for some people that might not be, specifically know BV, it's a very unique platform where you're leveraging, as you mentioned, venture capital, policy, and community building. Could you expand a bit more on Breakthrough Energy platform as such, its uniqueness, and how it differentiates from any other VC partnership that might today or tomorrow set up a VC fund?
Oh, absolutely. I think this is fascinating. In fact, Brooke, let me describe it. So I mentioned in Material Impact that I co-founded that with Adam Sharkawi. Let me name some of the people who were the core unit of folks in the earliest of days of BEV, yeah, when we're sitting around the table and looking at the firm and describe what was unique in our eyes as we were sitting and looking at each other. So my co-investment committee member, the two of us, the other person is Eric Toon, who's a near and dear friend of mine and former professor emeritus from Duke. Then there was Christian Garcia and Dave Danielson, and the person who runs all of BEV for Bill is Rody Gadero, who's the executive director. He really recruited us. So that group sitting around the table, he sort of asked me, Carmichael, you've seen a lot of venture firms, you created your own, you seem to know everybody in the industry. How do you look at this one? And I'm going to say very boldly, I'm a historian. I look at the history of everything I'm involved with. And so I know venture capital's history really well. I can say this pretty strongly. There has never been a firm created in the way that this firm has been created. And if you define uniqueness as being different from anything you've ever seen, this is unique. I want you to think about this. 25 to 30 billionaires are exclusively the LPs in this fund. Forget about the number of billionaires. Let me go one step further and say some of the most powerful leaders in their geographies. So besides the net worth, it's you start to look at the fact that they have an infrastructure within their various geographies and what they do on the subject matter that could be a tremendous networking resource for the firm. Not in any area. Forget about just climate. Yeah. And never in history have you had that kind of an LP base on a firm where the fund was created before the people were actually recruited in to build the strategy. Find that in history. So that in itself is unique. So I'm going to name three things that are pretty unique to the firm. So that's one that's striking that everybody can see, led by Bill Gates. It's who's put the money in and who's on the board of this thing.
Yeah.
The second thing, which may not be as obvious to everyone, but is really unusual, is it's incredibly science and technology led. So what does that mean to be science led? Because I think lots of VC firms have people who have scientific acumen or maybe even scientific degrees. There are over 15 people on the team at BEV who have PhDs. And not just PhDs, you have got folks who were top of their game in various areas. Like I said, folks who are professors, engaged.
I'm, by the way, really fascinated by really how deep you guys get into themes and topics. And
yeah, credit goes to Eric Toon on that. Eric Toon is really great at looking at the grand challenges and the topics and proactively crafting that. And you good insight, Rokas. It's definitely through the scientific lens. And so that level of depth in technical does not exist again in any firm. Like I spent time in biotech where I think it's the closest you can get to it. But even there, you don't see this level of depth on the science leading. I mean, here's a clear example. There's a two-person investment committee. There's a business lead and there's a technical lead. I'm the business lead. I have a PhD and a postdoc from, where I was on track to be a professor, where in any other VC firm, I would be in the top 5%, if not the most technical oriented in that firm. And I'm the business lead by comparison. right? So that says it all, right? I'm the business guy. So that scientific and technically led, you know, combined with who the LP base is, really creates a really unique platform that then you can do some really interesting things with. And you heard me say the third piece a bit, and that's collaboration. So, you know, the other element that this allows for is if you have that uniqueness, a lot of, you know, you have the ability to then to collaborate with large companies in a really unique way. You can go in different geographies. You can do things in, on a government basis across the globe in a unique way. So you're set up to do tremendous collaboration. I would be remiss not to mention one other fact that's really interesting. There was one point that I looked at all the team members who not the investors, but the team members who are out doing deals on the ground, and the 20 some odd folks going to close to 25 people. And amazingly, that group, before they came to BEV, had started over 55 companies amongst in aggregate. So when I say it's one thing to have technical acumen, but it's more than that. Like these are entrepreneurial technical people.
Yeah.
People who have founded companies successfully, been CTOs, been CEOs, inventors. So it's a very unique platform that's been built, and it's necessary because the goals are audacious, right? If the goal is we have a deadline on climate. We're late.
Absolutely. And I think what it would really impress is if not only you have operators that, you know, I'm no disrespect for people that are building another app, but people that really solve most complex problems. So someone that I know from your team is Gaetan, and he literally solved one of the biggest crises in nuclear with the company that he founded, which is really fascinating.
Thank you for saying that. And you know what's funny? Gaetan, he's like me. People look at us as the business people and think about how technically strong he is. Right. And but you're right. Well, you know, right. He did something that's pretty amazing. And when the team is fortunate to have him on board, it's a prime example, but everyone has a story like that, which I think is very unique. So those are the three things, the uniqueness, the most visible uniqueness is really what Bill Gates did, which is who's actually backing this and how that network gets created. Then I'd say the thing that we deliberately engineered was a tremendously scientifically led group, including even on the business side. And the third thing is really just how you leverage that. And we're doing that. And that is tremendous amount of collaboration in everything that we approach.
It's fascinating. You mentioned one word that I take also, speed, to get to net zero. What do you think is the most challenging part of world's journey to net zero or even beyond to negative?
Well, you know, I just
mentioned, and I know this is a very long question.
I'm going to keep this one simple. You know, I'm going to try to, you know, get to the point on this one. I would say, you know, I'm going to believe that we have a ton of innovation and technology. And now, by the way, as compared to when BEV is started, a tremendous amount of money and phenomenal firms and entrepreneurs have come into the space alongside BEV. So we love the fact that there's a lot of company right now. 5 years ago, it was more lonely. Today, not lonely. It's an exciting thing. So I would say the bottleneck right now, we still have that green premium matter, you know. Yep. So think about it. And, you know, we have this. With BEV, we have this filter that we use on that guides the choices we make in which investments. And often we look at if the company gets to scale and this business gets to scale and this product gets fully deployed, can it remove at least half a gigaton of carbon per year? At least half a gigaton of carbon per year. Now, and by the way, we want to have, you know, amazing venture returns. Both things are very compatible, right? In that that means you are building a big business and you're getting into all the nooks and crannies. In order to get that GHG reduction, you really have scale is not just making a lot of stuff. Scale is like getting it deployed and you know, across the globe. How do so what is the biggest challenge? I think in order to do that, you have to achieve cost parity between both new innovations and legacy systems. So not close, but you know, to the cost, but you've got to really try to hit it. And ideally, if I dare so say this, you know, at some point, even, you know, without just simple subsidies, but look, if we can have true breaks given in different areas that in regions that get us there, that's great. But I think in the end, to really get things fully deployed, we got to get the economics right. And that is probably the biggest challenge, I think, and that we're going to see in terms of deployment towards net zero.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. So you've been an operator, you've been surrounded by a lot of operators, and as you mentioned, you know, you're still in at Core now, an investor, both in BV and at your own Material Impact Fund. What do you think makes a great VC investor, just from that journey where you observed other VC investors and now you're one yourself? What's your take on that?
Yeah, you know, I think, so let me first say, it's interesting. So to depend on what hat I have on, I'm an investor. Another day, I'm a scientist. And then another day, you know, I can, you know, be a nonprofit advocate. I think the one common thread is I'm an entrepreneur through and through with everything. And so I'm about to give you an answer, even though I'm an investor, through an entrepreneurial lens. I think what makes a great VC investor is finding talented people and helping them succeed beyond the check that's written. That's why I got into the business on the venture side. I never fashioned myself to be a venture capitalist, always understood I would be an entrepreneur. But in order for me to scale what I was doing, I felt like venture is the right venture, you know, being a venture capitalist investor was the right platform. As long as I can really hone in on finding talented people and help them, helping them succeed beyond the check that's written. And I think the, you know, the very best investors and how way they do it, do exactly that. In fact, the way I like to say it is, you know, I like to always give the analogy that really great entrepreneurs, they swim out into the ocean with their surfboard before you can even see a wave in any form. They're just
only waiting for it.
Yeah. And you know, you know, people probably drive by on the highway, you know, metaphorically speaking, look at them and say, what is he doing? What is she doing out there? What are they doing? It's cold out there. There's nothing there. There's a much better beaches that are crowded. See, that's not what great entrepreneurs do. They go out there and they swim out there with that surfboard and they just feel it. They know that wave is coming and they're prepared when ready to pop up and ride that wave appropriately. And I would say great VCs, they're paddling out there too. They're right out there too, you know? And that to me was what makes a great investor. And I would say that both when as a CEO, when I was raising money and had investors, and I definitely say that hold myself and my colleagues and peers accountable to the same thing. You know, that's what makes a great investor.
Amazing. I love this narrative. We have a big group of people of part of Kaufman Network that are listening to this. What advice do you have for our audience of VC investors, innovators, and LPs?
Wow, that's a great question. You know, I get that every once in a while. I will first say, first let me make an overarching statement to, you know, think about what I just said in terms of what makes a great investor. It's a humbling, hard business if you do it right. It's also an amazingly invigorating, rewarding business if you do it right. But sometimes, you know, waiting for that wave, catching that wave right, making sure you stay up on that surfboard, you don't get knocked over. You know, these things, you know, you have some control over and sometimes you don't. So if I were to give two pieces of advice here, and as I think about the audience of being, I guess, VC investors, existing, you know, aspiring innovators, LPs, maybe, I would say two things. First thing, keep in mind, and we've learned this in certainly in 2020, coming in 2021, life is unexpected. And in so many ways, it's short. And so what do you have control over? What you choose to do? Find those things that you're really passionate about, where like you, when you go to sleep, you have a problem going to sleep because you're just racing through your mind, you're excited or scared. When you wake up, heck, when you're sleeping at night, you're dreaming about it. So when you wake up, it's the first thing you think about and you're excited about it and you're stepping towards it. And then the second thing, so that's the first thing I would say, find those things because you have control over that. Yeah. And you know what the other thing you have control over that I would tell people to pay attention to is not only what you work on, which I just mentioned, but who you work with. You know, that part also is completely up to you. Most cases, right? Especially as your career develops, you know, you can make the choices about what you work on subject matter wise, and then very specifically, and you can make the choice of who you work with. And I would say make those choices really wisely so that, you know, you not only are setting yourself up by surrounding yourself with people who complement you, in some cases, if necessary, duplicate you, the essence of you, but also who just you enjoy spending time with, because I think that yields a better outcome.
That's amazing. So you're juggling with so many roles. Your life is probably insane. How do you stay sharp? What books do you read, podcasts, blogs inspire you? I know you're a big fan of spin, so that I've heard.
Well, let me see. So, you know, I'll state the obvious. You know, you can probably tell, like, I'm big on the human spirit side of stuff, on the people side. So, you know, people inspire me, but that's too broad of an answer. So let me, and those who know me, actually, the answer is related to that. I love biographies. You know, real live biographies of people who, you know, are doing their thing. And I, you know, so a lot of times what I'll get from my friends, my entrepreneurs, my family members, my co-investors, my LPs and so forth, they'll send me stuff like, check this out, Carmichael, read this thing that so-and-so is doing.
And I even sometimes do Wikipedia, to be honest. It's exactly. Fascinating.
isn't that good? And it's like, I love that. And, you know, and it kind of, and if you sort of say, like, but come on, like, what do I like to read? I mean, you know, I was the other day, I was reading Walter Isaacson's biography on Benjamin Franklin. I mean, I love reading the historical stuff and seeing how fascinating it is, the similarities in the present days. You're just amazing when you kind of see it. So I love biographies, whether it's snippets or books or volumes. Authors who do that, people who blog about the human spirit and stories, sometimes going in the right direction, sometimes going in the wrong direction. I learned from all of that. And I think that keeps me going. And I do that at all ages. You know, I even like the stories like we started out. I started out by telling you about the Carmichael, less than 5 years old, right? And growing up. And I think that's who I am. And that's what inspires me.
This has been an amazing chat. I could probably go for hours on all front and topics. Thank you so much, Carmichael. This has been amazing. And I'm 100% sure this is going to inspire a lot of entrepreneurs, investors to follow your path or find their own path. So it's really amazing. And it's really a great journey to net zero that you're pursuing and building that community and collaboration around.
Well, thank you, Rogers. And let me say, you're part of my audience, right? I mean, you're in that Kaufman group who is part of the future. So for me, the reason that this has been a pleasure to do so is to inspire people like you. So if you say this is going to inspire folks,
absolutely. Then
I got an N of one, buddy. I got an N of one. So even if no one else listened to it except for you, brother, and you go off and take something I said, then I'll take it.
Every day, I think we're doing it. I think BV is a great inspiration. So thanks a lot for joining today. Some, I guess, very busy time of your day, but I think this has been tremendous for me personally, and I think for the rest of the audience. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
That's a wrap. Tune in next week for another candid conversation on what makes a great VC investor with your host, the Kaufman Fellows.